Welcome to Rob's Reliability Project, a podcast for reliability and maintenance people to learn, improve, and better themselves at work and at home. Here's your host, Rob Kalvaroski.
Hey guys, welcome back to Rob's Reliability Project. This week's guest is Bob Latino. Bob is the CEO of Reliability Center, an author, and a speaker. This week we're talking about root cause analysis, or RCA. Bob gives us some great tips, so stay tuned for that interview. Rob's Reliability Project is available on 10 different platforms, including iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. So subscribe to your favorite platform so you get every new podcast. For all the links, go to anchor.fm/Rob's Reliability Project or reach out to me, Robert Kalvaroski, on LinkedIn. If you like the podcast, share it with your colleagues in reliability and maintenance. And it's especially good for people just breaking into the industry because there's a lot of great tips in here. If you prefer some short tips, I'm putting out a reliability tip of the day selected from these interviews. The feed is called Rob's Reliability Tip of the Day. They're available on 10 different platforms as well, including Amazon Alexa, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and iTunes. There's a tip every day, including the weekends, so subscribe to Rob's Reliability Tip of the Day on your favorite platform. Go to anchor.fm/Rob's Reliability Tip for all the links, or again, you can message me on LinkedIn as well. For any inquiries, questions, or if you'd like to appear on the podcast, email me at robsreliabilityproject@gmail.com. Now let's get on to the interview with the CEO of Reliability Center and root cause analysis expert, Bob Latino. Hey guys, I'm here with Bob Latino. If you don't know Bob, he is the CEO of Reliability Center. He's available. His website is www.reliability.com. He is a speaker. He's an author of Root Cause Analysis, Improving Performance for the Bottom Line Results and Patient Safety. And that includes the PROAC root cause approach. Bob, how's it going?
Very good. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Thanks for coming on. I really wanted to get you on because you do a ton of root cause analysis, and I think it's something in our industry that some people don't necessarily do correctly.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, like the one thing I've seen in the past is a lot of people use 5Y as a kind of a quick and dirty method, and it seems like, well, one, it's kind of a biased approach, and two is it doesn't get down to the root cause of the actual failure, but we'll get into that in a bit. So first thing is, can you give us a broad overview of what root cause analysis is and why we should use it?
Well, I'll give it to you from my perspective, because as you just described, there's a lot of people that define it differently. So I can just define it as we espouse it. You know, I don't think that there's a provider out there in the RCA business who likes the term RCA or root cause analysis, because it's a very misleading term. You know, it assumes that failure, that root cause analysis is linear and that you have a single root cause. And anybody worth their salt in this business doesn't believe that that's what RCA really is. But, you know, we're stuck with the term because, you know, if you wanted to call it critical thinking analysis, you know, who's going to go Google that term? You know, you're just stuck with a poor term of RCA. So there's no universally accepted definition for it either, so that makes it worse. So what anybody is doing with RCA to solve problems, they're going to call it RCA. We view RCA a little bit more holistically. It's a system, and it's not just a simple task. A lot of people say, you know, I had this major catastrophe, we're going to go do an investigation, and you know, they do that, they may do it well. And then it goes into a filing cabinet, and you know, it's not leveraged in any capacity. So they see RCA as a task and not a more comprehensive system. And you know, you described the RCA. A lot of people use 5Ys and call it RCA. I'm not one of those. I don't see 5Ys as a valid root cause analysis tool for numerous reasons. The linearity of it, the single cause, and the lack of evidence to support what people are saying. So we use that type of tool. I'm saying it has its place, but you know, we call that that would be shallow cause analysis if you're using 5Ys as a root cause analysis tool. So essentially for me, RCA has a public relations problem because the term has a negative connotation in the marketplace, and it's, to me, it's effectively useless as a term. How's that?
Well, that's a pretty bold statement to start off with. No, I definitely agree. Like root cause, I mean, especially with 5Ys, it's definitely a shallow cause analysis, and it's definitely like a low level type thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why it's not, you know, if you're going to go that way, why is it not 3Ys or 10Ys? I don't know where the magic number 5 comes from.
So it sounds good, I guess. So like if we're going to do an actual root cause investigation, what types of failures should we do them on?
Yeah, I guess this comes back to my perspective on using root cause analysis as a system and not as a task. It's most, you know, RCA has a negative connotation because usually we have to hit a trigger. And it's either going to be somebody's hurt, you lost a lot of money, you have a regulatory fine, but there's triggers that would say we mandate we have to do an RCA. Well, it's really too late by then. I'm not advocating that you don't do it then. I'm just saying you're not optimizing the value of the tool. That's a totally reactive use of the RCA tool, is that there's no reason that we shouldn't be able to use that on proactive types of failures, the chronic type of failures, the ones that happen every day but don't rise up to the level of a trigger that's been set. There's no reason we can't do an RCA on high risks that you find in your safety efforts, in your FMEAs. There's no reason, when you typically find out that 20% of the failure modes account for 80% of your losses and your risks. Well, why can't you go ahead and make that the top of your event and your RCA and say, you know, why do we have these risks that are so high? And use the exact same thought, breaking down the cause and effects of that to come to the conclusions. So, you know, we're big advocates for the proactive side of the RCA, but that's not very sexy because, there's no urgency associated with attacking opportunities. So usually when we're in a reactive state, you know, your adrenaline's up and everybody's pumped and you go out and say that we're going to apply RCA under those conditions. But there's no reason that we can't do this on the more chronic type of stuff.
Yeah. So that to me is more of a reliability engineering approach versus just like, I don't know what we call it, but like the reactive side is kind of, it's similar, I think, I work at oil analysis and we kind of look at it the same way, is like, are you doing it proactively or are you just looking to find failures, which is, again, it's reactive. Like it's on the predictive maintenance side, but it's still reactive.
Yeah. Why do we have to wait for something to happen when we can assess it from a risk standpoint versus wait for the consequences to materialize?
Absolutely. And so if we were going to do, like, let's say, like, I guess it was a few weeks ago, Joe Anderson came on the podcast and he was talking about how minor incidents, and what he defined a minor incident was something that took production down for 10 minutes or less. And he was saying that that's generally the most, like, it causes the most downtime across, you know, manufacturing operations. How would we do a root cause analysis on, you know, something like that?
Well, you know, we utilize a tool to aggregate things like that called opportunity analysis. And essentially the equation for it is simply the frequency times the cost per impact. And when you're looking at cost per impact, if you look at the labor that you had to use to address that one little situation, if you had to expend any materials to get back to a steady state, and whatever your lost profit opportunity costs were, or your downtime cost. Collectively, if you add those together and multiply it by how often it happens a year, those collectively are going to far outweigh any of these sporadic events that you have. So that really doing it, going about it that way makes the business case for why you should be doing RCA on things that did not meet a trigger. So it's extremely important for those in terms of the chronics. Now, a lot of people don't believe that the chronics lead to sporadics. I'm not one of those. I think that left unattended, those chronic things that happen on any given day, if you had one new thing happen, then that's the hole in the cheese that allows that to line up and cause a catastrophe. You know, I'll use Challenger on that one, and everybody uses Challenger, but, you know, it was an O-ring failure. You know, the thing that was different on that day, because that design flaw was there on all the previous missions. Had it not been 36 degrees that day and a decision to launch, you wouldn't have had that failure. Well, conversely, it had been 36 degrees on any other day of the launch, it would have happened then. So, you know, there were a lot of latent situations with that. But we have to understand that the value for RCA for me is that we want to be able to do it proactively. I don't want to have to deal with the disasters that happen. I want to be on the risk side and saying how can I prevent them from happening?
Absolutely. And I think that opportunity analysis is something that our industry doesn't do very well. I mean, there's definitely people who do it well, but it's like, if we aggregate, like in theory, we should be aggregating kind of all failures. Well, not necessarily failures, but all downtime, opportunity, safety, environmental events over the life cycle of our plant or mine or whatever, and then really pick out the biggest ones and attack them first.
Yeah, like I said, if you go ahead and do a Pareto of something like that, you're going to find a whole bunch of things that you never really thought about, because the frequency is the parameter that we rarely don't look at. You know, even when you have the bad actors list, you know, those tend to be short-term focused, because, you know, what is a bad actor today may not be a bad actor next week, and, you know, I move on to something new the week after. When you annualize the frequency of these chronic things that happen every shift, and it may only take 10 minutes, and you show that those results to a CFO over an annualized period, so that's a big deal. I'll give you a quick case from the healthcare industry that we can all relate to, is that when we go into the emergency room and they take our blood, an opportunity analysis we did with a hospital that we ended up publishing. But we were looking at how often they have to redraw the blood in the emergency room. And we were finding out that, you know, it seems like something, it's a no-brainer. And that when, you know, for whatever reason, you have to draw blood again, you know, how much can it cost? Well, if you look at the hospital as a system, you know, it's not just the person who's drawing the blood from you, but then it's got to be put into the container, and then it's got to be labeled properly. Then it's got to get to a lab, and then the lab has to look at it, and then it comes back. Well, there's a whole, that whole system is fraught with possibilities of things that could go wrong. Well, in this analysis that we did, we found out that the average cost of a redraw, when they had put all these numbers together, was about $300. And that really wasn't the startling part. It was happening 10,000 times a year. So you do the math. That's $3 million a year that is built into the cost of doing business, and nobody questions the need to have to do a redraw. There's a ton of those type of things in industry, and a lot of times they're not even in your CMMS systems, because it takes longer to put it in the CMMS system than it does to implement the workaround or the fix. So it's in the heads of the people that are closest to the work. So that's where your real value is. We got to get that information out of those people. And put it into a business case so they can relate to the CFO types, the finance people.
Yeah, that's a great example. That's a really great example. So let's get back to root cause analysis. And so if, let's say we had a significant failure at our site and we wanted to do a root cause analysis on it, how do we, like, what steps do we take? What resources do we need? And how long would it take?
Well, the vision I like to put in people's minds is, say, what does any other investigative occupation do when things like that happen? Because really, we're just reliability detectives when you're in an industrial setting. the process of a proper investigation, the steps are no different from a criminologist standpoint versus, you know, if you're in the nuclear field, the healthcare field, you know, they just have different incidents. The thought processes and the steps are the same. For us, you know, what do you see when you see on NCIS, CSI type of shows? The step one is the preservation and analysis of evidence. You know, they put the caution tape around it, the police tape, and they freeze everything. That's what we need to do. Oftentimes, when you look at weaknesses in RCA efforts, when anybody is time pressured, what they typically do will implement shortcuts. Well, the most time-consuming part of an RCA is going to be the collection of evidence. So that's where most of the shortcuts take place. We don't go through the effort and the discipline of collecting what we need at the, you know, in quotes, crime scene. Once we're able to go ahead and establish the initial data collection efforts, then we have to have a team put together that's going to be an effective team, an appropriate team. And the one thing that we tell our students is that, you know, the lead investigator should not have anything to lose or gain by the outcome. These should be unbiased people who have nothing to lose or gain by the outcome. Otherwise, they're going to taint the analysis, or their critics are going to use that against them. So if there's one thing I say in terms of the teaming aspects of that is that, you know, have somebody who's a facilitator, not a participator. All right, once we have all the data and then we have the proper eyes looking at this particular incident, now we have to go through the failure reconstruction stage. Now we use something we call a logic tree, which goes through a very disciplined cause and effect questioning process to create hypotheses. When you create a hypothesis, when you create the hypotheses, then you're going to have to use that evidence that we collected earlier to be able to prove or disprove all of these things that we come up with. The things that we continue to find out to be true, we drill deeper and deeper until we uncover the various types of root causes that we, at least the labels that we use of physical, human, and latent. Now, a lot of the people, there's a lot of people out there who are detractors from the logic tree approach. Because, again, when you're using cause and effect, they, in their minds, they see linearity. But failure typically does not have a single pathway. It has pathways in parallel. So they're non-linear interfaces that occur that can be graphically expressed. So that's typically the way that we approach that side of it. You know, and to those people that I, there's a tape we used to use in our class a long time ago from a futurist named Joel Barker. He said, those who say something is impossible should get out of the way of those who are doing it. That's the way I feel about, you know, our use of a logic tree and in the manner in which we execute it. Once you have the analysis done, the analytical part, you know, that I call this my 50% line, because now it's the 50% are the headaches, because now you have to communicate your findings and recommendations and get something done about it. Just the fact that we have a bunch of recommendations doesn't mean that anybody's implemented anything yet. So there has to be a tracking mechanism to be able to say that, you know, we have followed through completely. And just because we follow through completely doesn't mean that we have demonstrated a bottom line benefit. So we have to track for bottom line benefits. Any recommendations you have from an RCA should have a metric to track that shows its effectiveness. You know, just because I go out there and I implement, you know, use a checklist and say, well, I did this. Well, that really doesn't matter. If things didn't get better, then you may have had the wrong recommendation. You may have done it poorly. You may have not have found all the right causes. So RCA effectiveness should not be measured by the fact that we did tasks. Something on the bottom line has to go back to those finance people you were talking to justify, to say, we took these actions and it generated this type of ROI. So when you take all of those collectively, those steps, for us, it spells out PROACT, which is, you know, just our brand of it. The PR is preserving evidence. The O is the organizing of the team. The A is the analyzing of the evidence. The C is communicating findings and recommendations. And lastly, the T is to track. That's a mouthful, isn't it, Rob?
No, that was a great answer. So that's one thing I think that, again, is another thing that we struggle with is, like, reliability engineers as a whole, we're really good at, you know, coming up with recommendations, but we're not necessarily good at implementing them and ensuring that whatever we implemented is actually doing anything beneficial.
Yeah, it has to circle back to finance. I mean, you're not going to get the money and the resources you need unless you can demonstrate that all of that activity is generating a net value to the organization.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, now how do you, I guess that kind of leads me to this next question. How do you feel about organizations that have like these general rules for root cause? Like you need to do a root cause analysis on every failure that's over, you know, X dollars or some safety risk. Like, given that, you know, the threshold is generally, I mean, I've seen them that are pretty low. Like, how is it even possible to implement recommendation, like that many recommendations that quickly?
Well, I think that, and you know, we're dealing with non-specifics here, but that if you have that many types of failures, if a lot of times those failures are similar, and that the types of causes that you come up with from a system standpoint, they're going to be the same. Because when you get down into systemic failures, deficiencies in our organizational systems, they're going to affect a lot more than just the failure that you're working on. If you have, a training issue in your organization where there's a lack of effectiveness of training or we're not providing it to the right people, that's not going to be for the failure that you're working on. That's going to affect other areas of your operations. So systemically, organizational deficiencies they don't affect one person. They're not made for one person. They're made for a population. And therefore, you're working on more than the failure that you're on now when you address systemic roots.
Yeah, that's a good point. So let's get into that. So like what types of root causes, like you mentioned physical, human, latent. Do you want to break each of those down for us and kind of explain, like give us an example of what one would be? And
well, first of all, you know, these are labels that we use, physical, human, and latent. And there's not a generic set out there. And, you know, different providers had different labels. But conceptually, when you're drilling down from an undesirable outcome that has occurred, you're going to go through all three of these phases. You're going to go through the physics of the failure. Then you're going to, beneath the physics of the failure, you're going to have a human contribution. It's going to be an error of omission or an error of commission. And then beneath that, where the meat is for a root cause analysis, is not understanding who made a bad decision. We typically don't care about the who. You want to understand why that person on that day felt it was the right decision. And when you start getting in and exploring human reasoning, which is one of our fortes, is that you want to say, you know, that person didn't come to work. This is how they feed their family. They didn't come to work saying, I'm really going to screw up everything today. Their decisions were generally of well intent, and that normally anybody else in the same position would have made the same decision. So we have to understand why they felt it was the right thing to do. And that usually is going to uncover all these system flaws. You know, these are our policies and our procedures, our training mechanisms, our how we do our purchasing, for instance. And it's not always, these organizational systems also include the lack of managerial oversight. It doesn't mean that we don't have the rules. It means that people have veered away from the rules, taking all these shortcuts. And that, you know, when the shortcuts work out, all of a sudden they're heroes. But when the shortcuts don't work out, we discipline them. So where is the organizational oversight that starts to see this drift away from a standard because of these shortcuts, and we're not either, you know, fixing the standard or trying to stop the drift away from the standard that was set. So that's, you know, that's how it works out for us, is that, you know, if you're not getting down into understanding the human reasoning, you're not doing root cause analysis. If you stop and you blame somebody, there's a saying for this, and I like it, and I forget where it comes from. But we as leadership often judge people on their decisions based on the outcome of the decision. However, we as leadership want other people to judge us on our decisions based on our intent. If you're doing a proper RCA, you should be looking at the intent of the decisions and not just based on the outcomes of the decisions.
That's like, I hear that a lot in poker or economics. We talk about that called like, don't be results oriented in your, like when you analyze your decisions.
Yeah. And you know, this doesn't just apply to where we work, but this always applies in general about how we judge anybody about anything. But, you know, you have to look for the rationale for the decision, and anything that didn't go as planned, we have to look at, you know, what was the intent and why did they believe it to be true? That's really what RCA in our mind is all about. I did want to touch one thing that you were talking about, Rob, earlier, that how much effort do you put towards the RCA and based on the severity of it? You know, you do a $5 failure, you do a $5 analysis on a $5 failure. But when you have something that hits that trigger, you know, you usually have a bunch of the suits show up for that. And then, you know, this is a high visibility type of thing. We don't want to do a shallow cause analysis where a root cause analysis needs to be done. You also asked me about how long does this take? And then I wanted to quote a manager who asked me that. And it's a very generic question. I said, well, my answer to him was, if you have a team that puts 25% of their time to the analysis, it will take four times as long to do the analysis, because the analysis will accelerate based on the priority of the event. And, you know, it's important to somebody who's important. When you look at the things that are triggered, they're urgent now, because it's, you know, typically your production is down or somebody's hurt or something like that. But think about how hard it is to pursue the opportunities when that urgency doesn't exist, but they may be 10 times more costly on an annualized basis than these sporadic type of failures. So this is a leadership thing where they have to understand, what's the best way to leverage the finance side of the RCA, as opposed to only doing it after really bad things happen. There's a lot of money on the table for these chronic type of failures, much more money than you experience on the sporadic stuff. Sorry if I got off track there, Rob.
No. So would you recommend like doing an opportunity like analysis kind of on an annual basis to see where your organization is and then kind of prioritize your work that way?
It's probably too broad to be done, depending on the size of your organization, to do it on the whole organization. I definitely, on operating and business units, I would recommend doing that type of work. And I'll be quite blunt with you, as I don't typically see people doing it at all, even though we teach it in every class that we do. And it's because there's no regulatory driver to do it. They don't have to do it. You know, once you cross that trigger, you have a regulatory obligation to understand why it went wrong. But unfortunately, in the proactive world, it becomes optional.
Well, that's the nature of our industry, right? It's all about switching from that proactive or the reactive mindset to the proactive mindset.
Well, I don't know if you want, when we were originally a reliability R&D group back in 1970s, and I'm just going to go through the part about the organizational chart, because at that time there really wasn't reliability engineering was a new field. It's nearly 50 years ago. And when you're putting that on the organizational chart, you know, we always saw maintenance as the today people and reliability as the tomorrow people. But if you put reliability subordinate to a maintenance department, then you're going to have people whose job is to be proactive. They're going to be having to yield to all the reactive work, and they'll get to the proactive work when they get a chance. They'll never get a chance. So that's why we had made those separate departments, that they couldn't be subordinate to each other. Because if you're a reliability engineer and you're put in the maintenance department, and in organizations that do have those separate entities, then you're always going to be called upon for the reactive stuff, and it becomes frustrating too for those type of people who are proactive.
So why do you think that everyone puts reliability engineers in a maintenance department?
I don't know. It's been par for the course for us. Now we've been independent of Allied Chemical for 40 some years now. But we just see it repeated over and over, is that, to be a truly reliable organization, you have to be looking at tomorrow. And when you have to deal with the reactive stuff, that pulls you away from the proactive side and it pushes you into the reactive side. So given the choice, the urgency of the day is going to take over, and you're not going to be able to seize the opportunities of tomorrow.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, and that's why you see, like, at least talking about what we're talking about, is that's why you see the bigger sporadic failures take precedence over the small failures that happen every day.
Yeah, those are the ones that get attention. But, really, the more progressive managements are going to wonder why it got to that point. Why didn't we pick it up earlier?
For sure. So one thing I wanted to ask you, Bob, was, how do we know that we got to the lowest level for a cause? Because I think a lot of people, or at least what I've seen, is they stop at a level that's, higher than something that they can fix. Like you mentioned it, like where we're blaming the operator or blaming the mechanic for something. Now, how do we know we got to the actual lowest level?
Well, you have to get down into these latency issues. There's never a single latent root cause. When I was going through earlier of the physical, human, and latent, think about it. If you stop at the physical level, it's easier because we call those parts replacers. We say that we had fatigue on this, so we're going to go ahead and we're going to replace the part. Well, if you don't understand why had fatigue on that part, then the next part you're going to have in, you're going to get to do another analysis because the same thing's going to happen. So if you go a step deeper and you say, well, we had this person who misaligned, and that's we're going to have to discipline them because we can't have people out there misaligning. So if you go ahead and you discipline that person, are you getting rid of the problem of misalignment? No, because you don't understand why that person didn't know how to align properly. Did you give them the training? Did you give them the tools? And how come there wasn't some supervisory oversight that realized that you had a person in a position that was not qualified to do the job? So unless you get beneath understanding why that person chose to align in the way that they did, then you're going to have more problems, because you have not untapped the systemic contributions to the problem. And, you could take these analyses, if you wanted, back to Adam and Eve, because I can drill down further into understanding, why the regulatory laws are the way that they are. And, then you're going to get back into Congress and you're going to get into, so how deep do you have to go in any given analysis? Well, for me, it's to the point you go to the depth where you have control to make the change. Maybe my boss's boss had developed a procedure that was obsolete 20 years ago. Am I gonna go back and say, well, why would he have done that? No, it's irrelevant to me for right now. I'm not gonna go back and understand why Congress does what they do, because nobody would understand it. It's a matter of going down to where the solution is obvious. Is that when you get down and you understand that these mechanisms that are put in place to help us make better decisions aren't working, then we have to fix those mechanisms.
Awesome. Let's get one more question in before we wrap up. And so that last question is, what do you think the most common mistake that you see that people make doing a root cause analysis, and how do we avoid making that mistake?
Well, I think that the most common mistake people make is that they already know the answer, and that why the heck do I have to put this RCA team together when I have the answer? So they just go through the motions of having this team get to the same conclusion that they wanted them to. So they drive them to the conclusion that they want. This is what happens when you put the expert in the nature of the failure in charge of the failure, is that they will lead the team to predetermined conclusions. And when you're on a team with the perceived expert, then they're very intimidating, because they're probably the old timers like myself, the veterans out there. And you don't want to ask the seemingly stupid question to this person. So we just tend to, you know, agree. We roll with it. So we forego the discipline and the depth of asking, you know, how could something happen, using evidence to back it up, drilling down past the whodunit and getting into the systems that made sense at the time. So I think a lot of times we take the shortcuts because the expectation is not there to actually go through all the discipline.
Yeah. And I think that also, you know, like you mentioned an expert, but it also comes back to what you said at the beginning of the podcast, where you said having somebody who's a facilitator who has, you know, who's unbiased.
Well, there's a book years ago, and he had a lot of books, Eli Goldratt, of the Goal. One excerpt I took out of that book was, an expert is not someone that gives you the right answers, but someone that asks you the right questions. That's really what someone who leads an RCA team should be. Even if you had the answer, you shouldn't give it to them. You should ask them a question so that they have to derive that in their own minds. They have to derivate going through the cause and effect relationships to come up with what you want them to come up with. But if I just give somebody the answer and they didn't have to go through that in their mind, then they didn't learn.
Absolutely. Yeah, they didn't learn. They didn't even, like, they'll probably repeat the mistake, or they won't be part of the change, like the culture change either.
Well, I mean, that's like the organizations that will have an RCA software program where it goes through a series of drop-down boxes. And you just keep picking until you don't have to pick anymore, because you've met some regulatory requirement that you've picked enough boxes.
That answers the question. That's why there's five and five whys.
But, you know, a lot of about the difficulties of our business, and I speak in general, is that, you know, we're in the business of uncovering the truth. And most of the time, people don't want to know the truth. So there's the rub. You're going to have the fortitude to fight for the truth, because you're going to get a lot of resistance, because the truth usually involves that, leadership was involved in the sense that they're in charge of policies, procedures, and all of these organizational systems. And if they're flawed, they perceive that as you blaming them. However, when we're at a human root and we have that mechanic who misaligned, we have no problem disciplining them. But when you turn the mirror around and you look at it and say, you're part of the problem, that's when everything starts to collapse.
It's easy to place blame on somebody that's not yourself.
Yeah, it gets right back to that, judging people based on outcomes versus intent. Same thing.
So, I mean, first off, Bob, thanks for coming on the podcast. Thanks for sharing your expertise on root cause. If someone wanted to buy a root cause analysis from Reliability Center, how would they get in touch with you? Where could they find your stuff?
Reliability.com. Most everything we have on there is things that we do in terms of consulting and training and all the software tools to make your investigations more efficient. So that's typically how we operate out of there.
Perfect. And then are there any conferences that you're going to speak in at, or any books that you want people to read that you've written, anything like that?
The books should be on there. The Improving Performance for Bottom Line Results, that's in its fourth edition right now. There's another one. It's basically a rewrite of that same book, except for the healthcare industry. It's the PROACT approach to patient safety. So those two are, if you wanted to catch up on methodology. So other than that, you know, I'm on LinkedIn. As you know, Rob, I'm heavy on LinkedIn. So if you looked me up on LinkedIn and want to have any type of conversation, or if I can give you any reference guides and tools to help you go ahead and do better investigations, that's what we're all about.
Perfect. Yeah. So everyone follow Bob on LinkedIn. We'll put his, I'll put the link to his profile in the podcast notes. Bob, one thing I want to have you back on to talk about the correlation between reliability and life.
Yeah, that ought to be interesting. You're definitely going to have polar opposites on that one.
There's that one. And then I also wanted to talk to you about your investigation into reliability and safety.
Yeah, it's been a quite an interesting topic, and I've bounced around on the two different. I go to the different conferences on safety, and then I go to the conferences on reliability and maintenance, and they could not view it more differently. And I'm just in the middle trying to figure out why they both see it so differently. I've written, and I guess I seem like an instigator going from one side to the other side, but I'm truly just trying to understand how such bright people on both sides see it so differently.
Yeah, we'll head back on to talk about that more.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
Perfect. So, Bob, thanks for coming on. For everyone who's listening, subscribe to the podcast. It's available on, I believe it's 11 different platforms now. Wherever you get your podcast, subscribe to it. Rob's Reliability Project. If you have any questions or inquiries, or you want to appear on the podcast, email me at robsreliabilityproject@gmail.com. Or you can, again, just message me on LinkedIn. Bob and I are LinkedIn warriors, so we're always on there.
On my LinkedIn page, if you look at all the articles on there, there's a lot of really decent reference guides related to why parts fail, and a lot of different tools that you could use. So I invite you to go ahead and take advantage of just downloading those.
Perfect. Yeah, do that. And then also one thing I wanted to mention was I got a demo from on the PROACT software, and you guys have a bunch of, I guess they're root causes in there over, you know, how many ever 20, 30 years of experience. And there's really a ton of value in there. And so for anyone who's out there looking for a software, hit up Bob for, you know, maybe purchase it, or hit up Bob for a walkthrough. It's a great software. There's tons of value in there.
Yeah, I would like to put a plug for that. That's the PROACT On Demand. That's a cloud application where you don't really even need us involved in it. It's a subscriber. It's a subscription once a year, and it has the RCA templates as a feature within them. And I think it's like $50 a month or something. If you're looking at a cheap buy-in, if you're not working on a failure where you're going to get 10 times that, then it may not be worth it to you. But for that kind of money, you can go out there and make millions off of it on those chronic failures that you, if you annualize them. So thanks for reminding me about that.
No, absolutely. It's a great software, and I was very impressed with it.
Yeah. Thank you.
So everybody, subscribe to the podcast. Follow Bob Latino on LinkedIn. Follow me on LinkedIn. And we'll see you guys all next week. Yeah, with the sun shining in my hand.
Portrait of size.